It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Ovshinsky in for Rob Ferret.
We're continuing our conversation now with Charles Sennett, the vice president and co-founder of Global Post, about his Frontline documentary, Egypt in Crisis, which airs on Wisconsin Public Television tonight at 9 o'clock. And Charles, we were talking a little bit earlier. You introduced the term deep state. Could you tell us a little more about what that is when it comes to Egypt?
Yeah, the deep state is a word you hear a lot these days in Egypt. And the deep state refers to the presence that the military has throughout life in Egypt. It really is ubiquitous. The military controls vast land holdings. They build huge developments, housing developments, business developments. They control the ports. They control the toll roads. They control most of the industries. They control bottled water. They control the baking of bread. It's really a hard to imagine the extent to which the military is involved in the private sector economy.
It is hard to imagine. I mean, why do they do all that? Why does the military bake bread in Egypt? I don't understand.
Well, one thing that's true of Egypt's history from ancient times is that bread is one of the most important commodities, of course, in so many cultures, but that bread riots are a real fear in Egypt, that if the price of bread rises too high, riots can break out, and they have in different periods in history. But it's of course, no beneficent effort on the part of the military. It's cronyism. It's sort of Nasserist socialism meets military junta. You know, this is not uncommon. It's also the case in Burma and in other military juntas. But we in America have thought of Egypt as a country that we support, of course, with economic aid and military aid for decades. We think of them as signing the peace deal with Israel. And we haven't really focused on the brutality of that state as a police state under Mubarak until the uprisings happened and Mubarak was overthrown. So that deep state has been there for a very, very long time. One of the things that the revolutionaries, the people who really fought hard for a democracy in Egypt, they want to see the military come under civilian review. And the military has been very resistant to that. And that's one of the big tensions now in Egypt is it's very true that the military is a trusted institution and a respected one. Hard to imagine when they've got that level of cronyism, I guess, going on. But it is. And the Egyptian people view it that way. General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who is now heading the transitional government as the general in charge, so therefore really effectively leading the country right now, is popular. He's young for a general. He's sort of, I guess some people would see him as ruggedly handsome. And he's the guy right now who's in control, and he's the face of that military and that deep state. And I guess the Egyptians have collectively expressed to many of us who've been reporting there that as long as they hold new elections in early 2014, that they support this transition. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, which represents another large sector of Egypt, they don't support this. They think that the elected president was kicked out in a military coup, and they can't understand why the United States isn't more up in arms about that. And I think you can see both sides in this, and that's one of the really complex parts of Egypt right now, is that the country is divided, and that on one side is the popularly elected party of the Muslim Brotherhood that feels its election was stolen from them by the street, and on the other side is the street, which says we don't want the Muslim Brotherhood, and we're going to allow the military to take over in an interim. Now, will the military give up power? Will those elections go forward? Will the deep state recede and allow democracy to come forward? Huge questions, and I think it's what we try in the film to say is the reason that your listeners, and I'd argue the whole country of the United States, needs to think about what's going on in Egypt. It's a big test case for democracy in the post-Arab Spring. And it will have regional ramifications if it fails, and it will have, you know, good ramifications, positive ramifications if it succeeds. So I think we have a lot invested in working toward the success of democracy in a place like Egypt.
Well, when Egypt did rewrite its constitution, did it include some of the reforms that the revolutionaries were asking for?
Good question. And the short answer is no. I mean, the constitution was not liked, and it was very much one of the greatest failings of the Muslim Brotherhood's leadership under President Morsi and his political party, was that the constitution reflected too much of their religious agenda, too much social engineering. And people rejected it. And Morsi didn't listen to them, and he was not inclusive, and he did not include the rights of women enough, many women felt. He did not protect the rights of the Christian minority, according to the Christians. And that was, I think, maybe his greatest weakness that led to the enormous public uprising in the streets, calling for him to call for these early elections and to leave office.
Well, how would you describe how the Muslim Brotherhood is standing right now? What is next for them?
Right now, they're deeply underground. I'd say they're crushed. I would say that the Muslim Brotherhood the leadership is largely under arrest, often on very trumped-up charges. Those who aren't under arrest have warrants for their arrest, and they're literally in hiding. Much of the Muslim Brotherhood wasn't based in Cairo. It was based in the more rural areas outside of Cairo, or in the very poor areas on the fringes of Cairo, big, sprawling, poor neighborhoods in Cairo, where they very effectively set up their own kindergartens and health clinics and things that the government never provided for those poor neighborhoods, and where they're very popular and where they can hide. And they've basically gone back underground. And a very observant analyst in Egypt said, you know, this is their narrative. This is where they're the most comfortable, is underground, as an underdog, trying to fight against the state. And I think we would not be good students of history if we thought this was going to work. The Muslim Brotherhood organizes even more effectively this way, and it's going to come back, and it's going to assert itself. And the big question will be, you know, will it assert itself democratically, as it has for so many decades, even though it was outlawed? Or will there be breakaway factions that resort to violence? And I think it's a big question right now. And I think if there is violence coming from those breakaway factions, it's going to be really important to remember the history, that they tried democracy and they were thwarted in it. You know, and there are comparisons in the region, for example, to Algeria. In the early 90s, there were elections in Algeria, an Islamist government was elected. The military stepped in with tacit U.S. approval and crushed that election and took over in a coup. That caused a civil war inside Algeria that very few of us know about. I covered it, but it was very undercovered. And, you know, 75,000 people died in that civil war in Algeria that you didn't really ever hear about. But it was all over a military coup that thwarted the democratic aspirations of an Islamist movement. And I fear that if Egypt's too intent on pushing the Muslim Brotherhood underground, that there could be this backlash. And I'd hate to see that happen. Mm-hmm. It's a great country, and that shouldn't happen, and it doesn't have to happen. But I think we all need to know more about the hydraulics at work here.
Well, after President Morsi was ousted, after the violence, you started to hear some of the hope, you know, that had been blooming from the Arab Spring. The erosion of that is what we heard, and people starting to think, some analysts saying, well, maybe it's not that easy to grow democracy. Maybe it takes more time. Maybe some of these countries have to go through more transition before they get there. So with all that in context, and you having been there, we just have time for one more quick answer. But how optimistic are you that this will be a forward step for democracy in Egypt?
President Obama, in June 2009, gave a really important speech in Cairo where he talked about democracy as a universal ideal. And he encouraged Muslims all over the Arab world to bring on democracy. They answered that call, you could argue, with the Arab Spring, and they overthrew tyrants, and they want democracy. But democracy takes a long time. It's boring, it's hard work, and it needs support. And that is something that I think the U.S. needs to think about, is how can we, through civil society, support democracy? Because the best way to defeat militancy, al-Qaeda, and Islamic violence, or Islamist violence, is through ideas. And I'd argue there's no greater idea than democracy. And that's the idea that if the U.S. can put forward, can help change the direction in the Middle East and hopefully end the violence.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Charles Sennett, Vice President and co-founder of Global Post and correspondent for Frontline's Egypt in Crisis. His documentary will air tonight on public television. A lot of people have been coming down with a common cold lately, or something that looks like it, and that got us wondering, is there a chance to cure this thing?
Anne Palmenberg joins us now. She's a professor of biochemistry at UW-Madison, where she researches the common cold. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
All right. So I'm a little science challenged, so bear with me. What is the common cold?
The common cold is a disease caused by a virus infection called a rhinovirus, R-H-I-N-O, rhino, like in, as in rhinoceros, because they have noses. So it's a virus that replicates in your upper airways, particularly in the sinuses, and makes you sneeze and sniff and cough and spread the virus to your neighbors.
There have been, you know, vaccines for other viruses. Smallpox comes to mind. And, you know, we should at least get flu shots every year. Why isn't there a cold vaccine?
I would be very rich if there were one. The problem is that unlike smallpox and other things for which we have vaccines, there are 159 different variations of rhinovirus. For smallpox, there's only one. For polio, there's only three. For measles, there's one. And for influenza, for which you get your flu shots, in any given year, there are only maybe two or three variations that are circulating. But the 159 variations of rhinovirus that we know about now, and two or three new ones are coming up every year, that's far too many to make a vaccine against.
Well, why not make a vaccine with 159 variations?
Because you can't make a vaccine that contains all of those at one time. And the other main problem is that with the vaccines that are effective, like smallpox or polio or measles, for example, when you get a vaccination, you develop what's called an IgG response, which is a type of immune response which is protective against that virus if it circulates in your blood. And rhinoviruses, the replication of them is primarily in the sinus mucosal of your nose. And for that, you need a very special immune response called an IgA response. And typical vaccine administrations don't produce that kind of response. So we don't know how to make the good response, and even if we could make it, making it against 159 different types is essentially impractical.
So I have to sort of move the curtain here for a second and let you know something about radio stations, Anne, and it is that we are cesspools for colds and flus.
Yes, you are.
All it takes is one person and it spreads like wildfire. You know, obviously, we're all using the same microphones. How infectious is the common cold?
The common cold is highly infectious, although it actually spreads in a very strange manner. But you should be aware that right now, between 10 days and 2 weeks after Labor Day, is the peak of the rhinovirus infection season in Wisconsin. It happens when people come back from vacations or their kids come back from summer camp, and they take all of those new viruses that they've picked up and mix them. Talk about a cesspool. That's what happens. You mix and match them and exchange them, and the virus can be picked up by touching a doorknob that somebody is, you know, with contaminated hands has touched before you. If you touch your eyes, the virus infects extremely readily, and you pick up a new serotype. So there are probably, 10 or 15 serotypes circulating at any given time. And if you haven't seen all of them, you're going to get sick.
You know, having a cold is, I mean, usually just a nuisance. I mean, it's annoying for a few days and you get over it and you're back to work or you're back to school, or perhaps you're even doing both of those things while you're sick. Is the common cold more dangerous to people with conditions like asthma, for instance?
Yes, it is. Actually, it's a wonderful evolutionary trick of this virus not to make you really, really sick. Unlike flu, where you feel terrible and you stay home and don't spread it, rhinoviruses never make you so sick that you don't want to go to work and sneeze on your coworkers. So it spreads because it actually causes a fairly benign disease.
Is that evolution? I mean,
that's evolution. Yeah. You bet. And it's an extremely effective strategy because you are talking about how easily colds spread, and they do that because you never feel quite sick enough to stay home. Instead, you go out and spread it. But in terms of diseases, in most people, it's a mild disease, and it will pass within, you know, 10 days kind of thing. In some people, however, those with a propensity for asthma, rhinovirus infections will trigger an asthma exacerbation. And in fact, probably 80% of asthma exacerbations are triggered by rhinovirus infections. So young children with a propensity for asthma will get what should be a mild virus, and instead their immune systems go sort of nuts and go, ooh, terrible virus, and they react in a way that's inappropriate to that mild infection, and that's what causes the exacerbations in asthma.
You said that you'd be rich if you could invent a vaccine for the common cold.
Yes.
Is there anything on the horizon? Are scientists working on any sort of new methods to maybe conquer this thing?
Absolutely. Clearly, vaccines are, as I explained, are not the way to go because there are too many of them and we can't target it correctly. But once the viruses infect cells, a lot of the molecular biology of what they do inside cells is common to all 159. And so drugs which target the viral polymerase, for example, or the proteases that the virus uses when it's inside cells, basically virus genes that it carries with it, are common to all of these rhinoviruses, and those are where the most productive targets are.
And where do you see this? Where do you see this research going in the next 5, 10, 20 years? Is there money for this kind of research? Is this something that the government has heavily invested in?
Not so much the government, but Big Pharma is certainly invested in it. And virtually every large pharmaceutical firm has got a rhinovirus unit in it, and they're cranking out new compounds trying to test them against various rhinoviruses.
And I imagine with the number of people who get the common cold, there's also dollar signs there at the end of the rainbow.
There are dollar signs there, but it has to be done with a caveat. Because rhinoviruses are a mild disease, you need to be very, very careful about safety considerations. You can't put a drug out there that would cure the common cold but might have inadvertent effects against your, say, diabetes medicine or your heart medicine. So over-the-counter drugs or even doctor-prescribed drugs against a mild disease can't cause problems that would be worse than that disease. And so the safety stringencies are a big consideration. I know a lot of drugs that will take out rhinoviruses, but they would not be safe to use in a general population.
And why wouldn't they be safe to use?
Because they co-react with other drugs that people might be taking. If a rhinovirus drug were to reduce the potency of your heart medicine, for example, this would not be a good thing.
I imagine not. Now, obviously, one of the things that I have a checklist on in my little cubicle, having worked in radio now for a while, and it's really a list of the differences between flu and cold. What are some of the warning signs that somebody is coming down with a cold versus, say, the flu? Give me a laundry list.
Well, rhinoviruses, which are the mild infections, usually start with that tickle in your throat. And you sort of get a very, very mild sore throat, which goes away within a day or so. And then the virus infection moves up into your upper sinuses, and you get a runny nose and runny eyes, and you have to blow your nose a lot. Influenza, on the other hand, may start in your throat very transiently, but then will move into the upper respiratory, your upper lungs, basically. And you develop into a cough, and the virus can actually move deeper into your lungs and cause pneumonia. The achiness that you get with an influenza is something you will not get with a rhinovirus. Rhinovirus is the teary, watery-eyed, lots of Kleenex kind of virus, but you don't ache all over as you would with a flu.
And we've only got another minute or so left here in the interview, and I want to ask, you know, what are some of the ways to treat the common cold? In recent years, I've heard reporting having to do with, you know, young kids and cold medicines and how recommendations are changing there. How do we treat kids with the common cold? Should we just let the cold run its course?
Actually, clinical studies say that's probably the best way to go. Rhinoviruses don't cause fevers for the most part, so you don't need to treat the fever. So over-the-counter medicines that deal with the symptoms that are appropriate to that particular cold are probably the best way to go.
When can we expect the cold season to end here in Wisconsin? Is there any end in sight?
Well, it will drop off precipitously in the next 2 weeks. So the peak is always the 10 days to 2 weeks after Labor Day, and after that there will be a dip until spring break.
Music to my ears. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
That was Ann Palmenberg, professor of biochemistry at UW-Madison.
You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Avshinsky. And today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we're talking about what it's like to travel alone as a woman.
But first, we're talking about a plan to expand a new kind of assessment in Milwaukee's public schools, one that does not use traditional letter grades.
The school system says they're starting to use a new way to grade students that gives teachers and parents a better idea of how well they're learning. This program is not new, but it's now being extended to all schools in the Milwaukee Public School District.
Ann Nackert and Tina Flood joined us earlier to explain what Milwaukee's new grading system will be and why they're changing. Tina is the Chief Academic Officer for Milwaukee Public Schools, and Ann is an Instructional Technology Curriculum Specialist. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
And Tina, thank you so much for being here as well.
You're welcome. Good afternoon.
So, Tina, let's start with you. The Milwaukee School District is moving away from the A through F grading system for K through 8 students. Why the move?
Well, I think what people have to understand is this is not something new to the district. We've actually been working on this for 5 years. It's been a process over time, but we're really doing it because it's best practice for kids and for their parents to truly help them understand what their kids know and are able to do. So if you think about a traditional letter grade, so if we tell a parent your child has earned a C in math, you have to do a lot of digging to really understand what that C means. Whereas if you take mathematics and break it apart into the standards, you can then report to a parent how their child is doing on the different standard areas. So for example, number and operations versus mathematical practices versus, you know, another standard in math.
And now, Anne, as I understand it, the new system will sort of decouple academic achievement from sort of the social aspect of things. Can you explain that decoupling and how that works?
Sure. For the last 5 years, we've had schools that have been using this new report card. We've phased them in over the last 5 years. And from the beginning, we separated academic achievement from non-academic factors. And so in each content area, besides listing the standards in that content area, like the math standards that Tina was saying, we also include a line where teachers can indicate the effort in that content area, since we know some students really love math but may not like to write, or vice versa. And then we also have an additional section that we call personal social development, and that section has a series of items that are sort of those process skills, how kids do school. And in that area, the teacher can indicate whether a student turns work in on time, whether a student gets along with their peers, shows respect for adults, and a number of other items. So it really allows the parent to see both academic and non-academic progress.
And Tina, instead of an A through F is what we're used to seeing, the traditional grading scale, what will students see on their report card and what will it mean?
So it's broken out into four different categories. So they would see advanced, proficient, minimal, and basic. And that actually mirrors our other assessments, that terminology. So it's terminology that parents are familiar with.
So it's going to be, what did I see, like a PR will be proficient. And, I mean, it seems like with these new levels, parents are going to need to get used to this. Kids are going to need to get used to this. Is it going to be a big sea change in how parents and students think about school and their performance there?
So as we've already stated, we've been working on this for 5 years. So we've done a lot of work to help educate parents and students. We have a parent resource guide that's available on our portal where it really explains the entire process and then what the report card looks like, what the different levels mean. So we think we've done a lot of work to really help parents understand what this means for their student.
And according to advocates, this is supposed to better serve the Common Core standards that lots of places are voluntarily adopting. How do you see that working together?
Well, I think regardless of the standards, whether it's Common Core or the Wisconsin Model Academic Standards, the whole point is to really give parents and students a better idea of how they're performing against those standards.
And critics are saying that it's just going to make it harder to find failing students, that it might blur the line between who's succeeding and not succeeding. And Milwaukee Public Schools have been struggling for a while with this. And, you know, some people, critics are looking at it and saying this is just making it harder to pinpoint, you know, the failure of the schools or the students. What do you say to that?
I totally disagree. I think the opposite is, in fact, true. I think this will help us do a better job of really identifying where students are being successful, and then it will also help us identify areas that students still need support and more work on.
Now, what about homework? Homework has been, you know, a staple of what students go through in school. They have to turn it in, and it counts for part of their grade. How does homework factor in with this new system?
So homework is still important because we want students to be able to practice at home, but what we want is students to have multiple opportunities to show that they're proficient or that they can be successful towards a standard. So the homework is turned in, but we're more concerned about how they're doing on the homework, and again, giving them multiple opportunities to show that versus did they get it in on time and how many points is this worth. So we're not saying that homework's not important, but we want to make sure that we're keeping everything in context and providing students multiple opportunities to show success.
And Tina, what sort of feedback are you getting so far from people, from parents especially?
I think once we bring parents in and we're able to explain it to them and they go through parent-teacher conferences where they're able to sit down with their teacher and their student in some cases and they really walk them through what this means, I think parents have really been responding in a very positive way because it does give them more information about their child.
Now, Anne, one of the things I imagine that teachers might be concerned about is that this is more work for them instead of a single grade, although I suppose they were evaluating all of these things anyway and just rolling into the grade. But are teachers concerned that this is going to be a lot more work for them?
I think, again, once teachers get involved in the process, you know, change is hard for everyone, but when a teacher gets involved in the process, they realize that this is helping them in many ways. So in the end, it results in a grade that's divided up by standard, but in the meantime, it helps teachers do the things they're being asked to do anyways, which is differentiate their instruction based on the needs of the student. And this type of grading really allows the teacher to focus in on where those strengths and weaknesses are in their classroom and to really give students the interventions that they need.
Will it be easier, do you think, to pinpoint students who may be struggling with, you know, just the basics of being organized and turning in homework and things that are more sort of less about understanding and more about the mechanics of what makes learning happen?
I think that's the interesting thing about being a teacher is that you play many different roles. So not only are you teaching children academically, but you're teaching children how to behave socially, you're teaching them how to be responsible, and none of those things have moved away. A teacher is still doing all those things. But I feel like in this system, it's in a less punitive manner, meaning our goal isn't to say gotcha. Our goal is to help kids, support kids, and help them be as successful as they can be.
Now, I don't know if you've been following some of the coverage of this. This sort of broke this morning. You've been aware of it and have been tracking it for a long time. But just reading the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article this morning, a lot of comments are a lot of people who are dubious about this, critical of it. And you know, some people saying it points to, you know, the slippery slope of American schools heading downward. What do you say to reassure those people, Tina?
Well, I think I think people make comments sometimes about things that they don't truly understand. And I think if we had the opportunity to really sit down and explain this to people and walk them through it, they would be less quick to react with those kind of statements.
But what about actually standing up for it as a merit-based thing, about why you think it's worth doing?
Again, I would have to go back to this is best practice, and it really does give us more information about students, and it helps us communicate on a deeper level to parents about where their students are compared to the standards.
Now, this is only used, as I understand it, for kids in grades K through 8, so why not high school?
So there's two things you have to keep in mind. So we have the standards-based report card, which is the actual tool, which we're using in grades K through 8. And then there's the whole idea around standards-based grading, which is the practice. And we do have many of our high schools who are working on reflecting on their grading practices and really moving towards standards-based grading practices. But we have not moved the high schools to a standards-based report card at this time.
Do you expect to be doing that? Are there models of high schools who are doing just that?
I don't think we plan to do it anytime in the near future, but we certainly want to continue to work with teachers on their grading practices.
Now, will you be assessing, Anne, as you go along to see whether or not this is actually working for a big school district like Milwaukee?
Absolutely. We've done surveys of parents, we've done surveys of teachers, and we're really sort of paying attention to sort of the feedback that we're getting from all the different stakeholders.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
And Tina, thanks to you as well.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That was Tina Flood, Chief Academic Officer for Milwaukee Public Schools, and Anne Nackert, an Instructional Technology Curriculum Specialist there.
The tales of travel writers have enchanted readers for centuries. The idea of going where the wind takes you and investigating the unknown has attracted some of the best men the literary world has to offer.
And that's just it. Most of those travel writers are, in fact, men. And there's more to it than which jobs are and aren't open to women. According to our next guest, going on adventures can be different for women. A travel writer herself, she says there's a voice in the back of her head warning her. Don't get yourself raped.
And because of that, she says she can't just go where the wind takes her, say yes to every experience that comes her way.
And that got us wondering, beyond just traveling, do some women forego adventures because they're worried about their personal security? Joining us from Belgrade, Serbia is Tara Isabel Burton. She's a travel writer and Clarendon Scholar at Trinity College in Oxford. Her recent article in Salon is called The Dangers of Traveling While Female. Tara, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. Lovely to be here.
You say you didn't realize you were subconsciously worried about being raped when you first began traveling. When did you start to realize that it was sort of this quiet whisper in the back of your head informing a lot of the choices that you were making?
I started traveling relatively young. My family moved around a lot when I was younger, and I'd start when I was about 14 or 15 going out alone, and I'd realized that the way I was being treated in the street when I was still very much mentally a child and maybe physically didn't quite look like a child, the kind of attention I was getting was a sort of a combination of everything that you internalize as a child, don't talk to strangers, but a very particular threatening kind of attention that I hadn't necessarily expected. And I think getting that kind of attention early on and having people really willing to not only press boundaries but take advantage of the fact that often as a when you're that young, you're nervous about saying no or please leave me alone or behaving in a way that seems impolite to adults. And I think early on I realized that there were people who would be very keen to test or push my boundaries and do what they could regardless of my comfort level, even if it was a case of just talking to me, asking for my number, asking for my name. And I think that's an experience that even though I'm older and better able to take care of myself, really stuck with me and informed how I do travel even now.
Now, you're a travel writer now. You make your living doing this, and you've been all over the world. And, you know, I'm sure that you've read the guidebooks and the advice for women traveling alone, how to keep yourself safe. Even with all of this knowledge that you have and all of this experience, how big a factor is that worry, that fear of being raped and maybe murdered along with it? How does that inform what you do now that you're older?
I'd say that the sort of the fear of being raped or being murdered, these sort of very big fears, are not always at the front of my mind as much as a fear of getting in an awkward, potentially violent position that's not necessarily me being, you know, hit on the head and dragged into the back of a van, but me being in a room alone with someone in the back of a shop, or I was in an art gallery the other day in Tbilisi, and I ended up in a back room alone with a man who, as I was looking at these paintings, made it very clear that, you know, he started saying, you know, you're young, you're here alone, you don't have a boyfriend, and immediately my brain started going, I've got to look for the exits, I've got to make sure that I'm close to the light, I've got to see, you know, is anyone else in shouting distance. You know, it's very much a case not of worry about serious physical harm, but worrying about getting into those kind of uncomfortable positions where you do have to shout, you have to scream, you have to be violent, as I've had to be a couple of times. And unfortunately, that mild worry does color interactions because it's difficult to, let's say, this owner of an art gallery is trying to show me around. On the one hand, I want to be in the moment. I want to listen to the stories he has to tell. I want to absolutely sort of engage in a meaningful interaction as a writer, as a traveler. That's what traveling's all about. And there's just that pervasive sense of, well, if something does go wrong, if something does get awkward, where are the exits? how can I leave? And that makes it difficult to be really in the moment in the way that I'd like to be.
You've talked about this with some of your male friends who travel as well and who do things like crash at on the couch of somebody they just met, except ride somewhere, are able to kind of be pretty footloose and fancy free when they're traveling. And one of your male friends said, can't you just get over it? What do you think about that? Can you just get over it, or is this something that's just going to be with you forever?
I don't think I can just get over it, in the sense that I can't snap my fingers and make my situation, my experience, very different. I think I can work towards examining why I always prioritize sort of safety over adventure. I think many women growing up are taught, stay safe, don't take the subway late at night, don't wear clothes that call attention to yourself. Men are often taught, children, make mistakes, maybe you'll break a few bones, maybe you'll get a bit muddy, but that's fine, it'll be all right in the end. To some degree, I think there is, it falls to me to examine, am I being overly cautious because I'm afraid of, shouting at someone, I'm afraid of a confrontation, and therefore I'm holding back. To some extent, I think it's worth saying, women should embrace some degree of risk and not always feel that sort of being extra safe at the cost of an experience or an adventure is always the way to go. At the same time, I don't think any amount of positive thinking or getting over it or willingness to go and do these kind of things will change the fact that often the way I am in public, my gender always, well, not always, but often becomes the first thing about me. If I accept an invitation, if some stranger says, do you want to stay on my couch, I can say yes, but me saying yes to a male stranger is often not the same thing as a man saying mm-hmm. yes to a male stranger. There's a sense that, in being so open and in accepting invitations and at talking to strangers, in many places that's perceived as me expressing sexual interest
right.
or expressing
well,
consent.
And I want to ask
so
you, as
the way people respond to me.
As a travel writer, you look up to some of literature's most famous male travel writers. And how do you think your experience differs from some of these big names in the travel writing world as a woman?
I suppose it's the one that I wrote the article about, and the sort of one of my favorite travel writers is Patrick Leigh Fermor, who had all these adventures walking across Europe and slept in everything from haystacks to the home of countesses. And I'd love to be able to do that. And of course, Patrick Leigh Fermor wrote in a particular time, in a particular place, a member of a particular social class, as well as being a man. So he had those particular privileges. But I don't necessarily have that same freedom to see a haystack and say, well, I'll sleep here. I don't have to plan ahead. Oh, this group of shepherds in Crete has invited me to spend the night with them by their fire. Yes, of course I'll do that. I do have to be more reticent. But sometimes I think that there's a positive element to that. I think sometimes by letting go of this idea of I have to have an adventure, I let go of the idea that I have to be this lady adventuress or be the heroine of my own story, and that frees me up to listen to the stories of those around me, to watch and learn and sort of be less present in the story because I can't sort of go off and have these great sort of adventurous, risky experiences. Often I have access to experiences that male travel writers don't have and wouldn't often be considered adventures by Patrick Leigh Fermor or what have you. I have access to women's experiences. I've had landladies in places that I've lived. I've had the mother of a friend sit down at a kitchen and confide in me her worries about her son in the mountains of Sfaneti a few weeks ago in Georgia. These experiences aren't necessarily considered adventurous by common standards, but I think they're a hidden kind of adventure. They're the adventures and the experiences of 50% of the population that often get left out of Patrick Leigh Fermor's narrative or Bruce Chatwin's narrative.
Now we've only we've only got about a minute left, but I do want to ask you. I mean, you write about how some of these great male travel writers they write from a position of what you call unthinking privilege. What do you think your experience brings that's equally valid?
Well, I think I do have sort of a degree of privilege when I travel, of course, you know, being often, you know, financially freer than many in a place like the Republic of Georgia, where I travel, does give me, like Patrick Liefermer, a degree of sort of unthinking privilege that I think, well, I ought to be able to go here and do anything. But I think traveling as a woman and realizing, you know, sometimes my own experiences lead me to have to think about that, to hold back, to examine, you know, to examine the degree to which I ought to be sort of throwing myself out and having adventures, allows me to sometimes, I think, be a better traveler. I check myself, as it were, if I if I am seeking an adventure at the expense of engaging authentically with a culture.
And I think we have to leave it there. Tara, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but it's been a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Tara Isabella Burton, freelance writer and a Clarendon Scholar at Trinity College in Oxford. And what do you think? If you're a woman, do you say no to travel adventures if that come up because you're worried about safety? And does it interfere with your joy of travel? Post on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be talking with a politician named Ron Paul. I think you've heard of him, about his idea for fixing the American education system.
And we'll hear from the director of the Betty Ford Clinic about the challenges of addiction and how to overcome them.
Coming up after the news, it's Wisconsin Talk. We'll chart our way through the different dialects of the Dairyland. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Avshinsky. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.